They are for necessary services and were subject to the Quantum Merit Rule. We have a little different twist to put on it. In the case of incompetent persons, we have legal guardians. In Michigan, they're called conservators when they only have authority to deal with property and assets. And in Michigan, they're called guardians when they have responsibility for taking care of the personal needs of somebody. And sometimes a person can be both a guardian and a conservator. Just to give you a little background on Michigan law. Whichever the case may be, whether we call them a guardian or a conservator, since that person's been appointed by the court, only that person can enter into a binding contract on behalf of the ward, we'll call them, protected person. Which means that any contract between the ward or the protected person is void. It's not voidable. Because their power to contract has been taken away from them legally by the court, and the court appointed a guardian or conservator to take care of their needs and their interests. So to that extent, it's changed. But other than that, if there is no guardian or conservator, but the person's been proven to be mentally incompetent, then the same rule as with minors applies. The next thing here is intoxicated persons. The most famous sports contracts in Michigan history was made on a bar there. In a bar and lounge between Bo Schembechler and the Detroit Tigers. When the Detroit Tigers hired Bo Schembechler away from being athletic director at the University of Michigan and hired him for some strange reason, I'll never know why that was, general manager of the Detroit Tigers. Contract can be on anything. We have another little chapter on that. Barnett, paper, this wall here, can be on anything. But intoxicated persons, it's a matter of degree of intoxication. This gets to be a subjective thing. If the person was intoxicated to the point where they do not know that a contract is being made, the contract is void. We're on the bottom of 313 if you're over. If the person just had a few drinks and they intended to do a contract, they thought there was a contract, but now they want to cherry pick it and say, if I hadn't been drinking, I wouldn't have agreed to this, and if I hadn't been drinking, I don't think I'd agree to that. No. That's not a defense. You're not going to be relieved of the consequences of your own negligence under those situations. But if the intoxication is to the point where they had no idea they signed a contract, it's voidable. If the other person is just as intoxicated, then we have no meeting of minds. So contract after the meeting of the minds, not meeting of the drunk minds. Lucas?
This contract law is decided by the judge, correct? And it's to the same extent as there are other civil cases where it's just
all
a preponderance?
All the judge can do is decide money damages.
Right. So it's just a preponderance of evidence, not...
Preponderance of the evidence standard, more likely than not. Nick?
I got a question about the illness. We dealt with this at the last company I worked for with union reps would come into our company a lot because we were a non-union company, worked in Three Rivers and Woven. And a lot of union reps would come in and talk to different guys in those different groups and try to get us to go union, to vote for going union. And a lot of the times what they would do is they would put a piece of paper out or something, or a business card, like, oh, well, just sign here or write your name and number down so I can get a hold of you whenever. But it would be a contractual statement or something where they would just take your name and put that on the vote list. So then when they go to vote for union companies, they have all these names of people that didn't even know they voted.
That's how they get by. That's how they get there. When the workers vote to be unionized, that's a contract between them and the union. And when they do that, under federal law, the union has to be allowed to be formed.
So technically, if a whole bunch of people signed something, they didn't know they were signing, they could go back and say, well, they never told me I was signing that.
I don't see a judge having a whole lot of patience for a lawsuit like that, they say. Don't come in and busy up my docket for something like that. They probably wouldn't get anywhere with the judge. Let's see. Mistake is the next category. Avoidability. You can have lots of different kinds of mistakes. You can can have a contract in which both parties were mistaken as to what was in it. You can have a contract that's signed in which one of the two parties didn't understand what was in it and the other one did. You can have a contract in which both sides understood the substance, but there was a typographical error that nobody caught before they signed it. So these scenarios can come up. If one of the two parties, called unilateral mistake, understood the contract to be something other than what was written, that's not a basis by itself for avoidable situation, not a basis to get out of the contract. Except, there's an exception, when the other party that's not mistaken knew the other party was mistaken, knew that the other party didn't understand it, and didn't straighten it out, and didn't tell them. Because they're talking to this guy. Okay? They're talking to each other. And the one party is talking in a way, that's kind of not what we agreed to. But he already signed it, mistakenly believing it to be, probably because he didn't read it. Which is, I'm going to emphasize this, I'm going to drill this into your head before you finish with me. Don't ever sign anything without reading it and understanding it and asking questions. You know, there's nothing that says that because somebody hands you a printed form, and it's got a place for your signature on it that you can't quibble, negotiate, counteroffer, talk to them. That's what you can do. That's what the law says you can do. You should do it. But if you know that somebody's got the mistaken understanding of a contract that they have already signed, and you allow them to continue with that misunderstanding, you let them sign it, and then try to take advantage of it, the other party, once they realize their mistake, can get out of it. So, unilateral mistake, only one of the two parties doesn't understand what's in the written contract, is a basis to get out of it by that party only when the other party knew they were mistaken and let them sign it and let them think that the contract was other than what it actually was. That's unilateral mistake. Mutual mistake, well, you wouldn't have a meeting of the minds. If neither party understood what was in the written contract, you don't have a meeting of the minds, you don't have mutuality of obligation, and the contract is voidable. Right, now, they do give you an example here in 315, a rare situation that might not be. If both parties believe that a colt is not fast enough to develop into a competitive racehorse, so they do a sale, and then suddenly the animal later develops into the winner of the Preakness, the seller cannot rescind the contract based upon a mutual mistake because the mutual mistake was a mistake in judgment as opposed to a mistake on what's in the written contract, the difference. And of course, if that's when you file the lawsuit, you have latches again, wouldn't you? Trying to get an equitable remedy, waiting way too late. Once you realize the other party made a lot of money on the deal, too late. Typographical error, page 316. The party has the right to come in and get the court to order the typographical errors be fixed. You almost would never have to do that. Both parties are usually going to agree to that. Deception, misrepresentation, fraud. Even though I didn't tell you at the time we were doing intentional torts, I saved this for now because I didn't want to get you too far off in the contracts at that point. The fraudulent misrepresentation is not only a basis to get out of the contract, it's a category avoidable. Also, intentional tort at the same time. So we had all the categories: minor, incompetent person, a special situation involving unilateral mistake when you have the back. The other party's knowledge. Void, You have contract with a person who has a court guardian. Now let's talk about fraudulent misrepresentation. Con job. If you can establish these elements, you can sue somebody for the intentional tort of fraudulent misrepresentation, in addition to being able to get out of a contract. Why would you do that? Why would you do both? Because if you sue them for an intentional tort, you can get money damages that you wouldn't be able to get in just trying to get out of a contract. You can sue the person for consequential damages in this situation. So a false statement of a material fact is the first element in this intentional tort. That's a nice way, a lot of words, to say a lie. Material fact. Material fact is a fact essential to the transaction, not a minor detail. The kind of fact you would rely upon to make a decision in making a deal or a sale is important. An important fact is a material fact. And it was made with the second element, with the intent to deceive. You knew you were lying to somebody because you wanted something from them. And you were intending to deceive them so that you could get what they had that you didn't have. Intent to deceive. By the way, Jeremy, this is simultaneously the crime of false pretenses of omission, too. Same thing, back same element. So that's the subjective part. Now we have the objective part. The reliance by the victim, the one believing the lie, was reasonable. It's reasonable because the victim could believe that this guy was actually telling the truth, not just kind of lying to him. It's reasonable to believe that this person had enough knowledge to know what they were talking about and that they were telling them the truth. Now, if I stood up here after having several glasses of Hunratty's Irish Mead from Dublin, it would not be reasonable for you to rely upon anything that I say. You could not rely upon anything that I say. Under those circumstances. So you're speaking to somebody who's drunk, you can't rely on what they say. I'm speaking to somebody who obviously doesn't have a knowledge base to know what they're talking about. You can't rely upon it. So you're talking to a high school, I'm making them 18, a high school senior who's 18, and they're trying to tell you about aeronautical and nuclear physics. Maybe some 18-year-olds might know enough, might have enough knowledge base. Probably not. You can't rely upon what they say in a matter of nuclear physics because they wouldn't have the knowledge base. Just not reasonable to believe. So if it's not reasonable to believe that what they're telling is true, then you're not being deceived by it. And final element, as a result of this lie, parted with value. Usually, but not always, money. These are the elements of fraudulent misrepresentation, or con, fraud. If this is what happens, to induce you to enter into a contract, the contract is voidable. The contract law, they call it fraud in the inducement. In the book, and that's the category of voidable. They call it fraud in the inducement in the book. For contracts, torts, it's the tort of fraudulent misrepresentation. If you're in this situation on the side of the victim, you can allege this and you can sue for the tort of that. Get money damages. Statement of opinion or value on the bottom of 317. You have to distinguish between assertions of fact and opinion once again. Just we have that, as we have that in defamation law, it comes back to us here. it's not fraudulent misrepresentation when salespeople give us a bunch of sales hype and exaggerate things. Because we expect that that's what salespeople do, to get sales or commissions. So if a statement is it appears to be the opinion of the salesman, it's not reasonable to rely upon that opinion when we get the sale of goods later. We're going to actually, there's an exception to this. I don't want to worry about that now. We'll get to that later. We expect they're going to exaggerate and they're going to give us opinions that this is such a wonderful car because that's what they do. But an assertion of fact, let's say it's a used car, this car has a rebuilt engine. That's not an opinion. That's not, I have an opinion. I think it's got a rebuilt engine. I'm saying it does have a rebuilt engine. Let's say he knows it doesn't. He knows that that odometer was actually rolled back. That's going to be fraudulent misrepresentation because he made a false statement of material fact. This is the actual mileage on it, even though he knows his own odometer was rolled back. He's intending to deceive because he wanted him to believe that was true, so he'd buy the car at that price. The victim didn't have any reason to believe. He looked at the odometer, and he didn't have any way of knowing whether or not it was rolled back. His reliance was reasonable. He bought the car, and it turned out to have a couple hundred thousand more miles on it than what he thought it had. That would be a classic fraudulent misrepresentation. But because he bought the car because the salesman was saying, man, I'm telling you, I've had great success with this car. A couple of my friends had these cars, and they really like it, and all this kind of sales hype and exaggeration kind of stuff. And we have a multiple choice question on the next test on that. Two, you've got to distinguish between opinions, vague statements of value, as opposed to specific assertions of fact about an item. Because only in the latter situation can it be fraudulent misrepresentation. Negligent misrepresentation on page 320. Michigan doesn't recognize this court. So I'm not going to hold the response to this court. So we have that again. All right, let's look at some more avoidability situations.
It's low on the more so you can see.
On new employee. You take advantage of a vulnerable person, maybe a senior, older person, a person who's sick, a person who's handicapped, a person who relies upon you, you know that they rely upon you and your judgment for making decisions. And you want them to get a car, this car, because you know you're going to be the one that's driving it. And they don't really need a car. But you want that car for yourself. And so you finagle that person into agreeing to buy that car. Probably lie to him a little bit about why he needs the car. About the fact that, and you don't tell him that you're going to be the one that's going to be driving that car all the time. This vulnerable person agrees to buy the car, and you end up with the car. That would be avoidable situation. Undue influence. Undue influence was used to induce somebody to enter into a contract when they otherwise wouldn't have. We have another category of void. So far, we've only got two. The person who was a court guardian, and what was the other one? Oh, illegal subject matter. But also, a different kind of fraud. Not fraud in the inducement, not in the lie situation, but fraud in the execution of the contract. That's void. Creates a void contract in which, for public policy reasons, the court will not allow either party to enforce it. Fraud in the execution. Papers were slipped. in place of the one you thought you had in front of you to sign through clever means. You, because of what the other parties, how slick they were, their fraud, actually had you thinking you were signing a document that you actually weren't signing, you were signing another different contract. And you never knew it. You weren't induced, you intended to sign a contract, but not the one that you actually ended up with your signature because of the fraud. Lucas?
When I bought my house, they put like a stack of 700, literally, you know, 70 pages of stuff in front of me, and the realtor would hand me one and say, this is what it says, hand me the next one and say, this is what it says, and we were just expected to sign them. I didn't read them. So if the person that was handing them to me was lying, yeah, but if they were lying to me, is it my problem because I didn't read them, or is there fraud here because I was relying on them?
You could make an argument, you'd be making yourself stupid, but you
sure.
Could make the argument that you really couldn't have understood it, and he convinced you that you didn't need to read it. He lied to you in a way that was reasonable for you to believe that it was in your best interest to make it a waste of time for you to read it. Yeah, you can make that argument, but I don't know if it's sounding all that great right now. But you could try.
Okay.
And, you know, some judges are real, real liberal. Some judges are real, real conservative. Some judges think the government has a duty to take care of every aspect of your life. Some judges say, basically, fend for yourself. This is a marketplace. This is a business world. You fend for yourself. You never know who you run into. And those circuit judges have got tremendous power in equity to be able to do pretty much whatever they want. The legal subject matter, fraud in the execution, person who is a court guardian, void contracts. These are all voidable ones over here. So it's a battle of avoids versus avoidables. So if on a legal wheel of fortune, I've got voidable contract as a term, and I say four, then you've got to give me four categories of voidable contracts. Legal wheel of fortune. Physical duress. Here's another void, and economic duress. Except economic duress is not the basis for avoidable contracts, certainly not the initial.
Say four.
Yeah. Physical duress, very simple. Gun to the head. Doesn't have to be quite that extreme. Well, Mr. Correll, I don't care if you read that contract or not. You're signing it, or I'm putting a bullet between your eyes. Up to you. Okay. No intent to enter a new contract. No mutual agreeable exchange of consideration. Just a criminal act.
What's your
and that would be the crime, Jeremy, of extortion.
What's that? I was just wondering what I can read your.
So eyes. Physical duress. Okay. Chapter 15, consideration. Get those problems. We already did problems tonight. Let's get on some more straight problems. Well, I give them those problems. I think even every contract sale. Consideration, of course, is the subject matter that's exchanged between the parties, the thing of value that's exchanged, money, services, or labor, usually. Two arrows on the board last week. Each arrow is the bargain for commitment that a party makes to another. That's the consideration. When I talk about gifts, you have to distinguish between gifts and contract. Remember that term gratuitous, if you've seen it right. Gratuitous obligation just means you did something nice for somebody. That doesn't mean there's a contract. Something nice for somebody. When we had the tremendous snow last Wednesday, I wasn't about to get out to Bay City. I had one of my friends. When you're a lawyer, you've got clients who can do just about anything. He has a snow plow. So I had him come down from Sanford and he plowed my driveway out. We have a couple older ladies on my block and I had him plow their driveway out. They were so thrilled.
Is his name Rod?
But they didn't have to pay him because that was gratuitous. I paid him, okay, to do their driveways, but they didn't have to because what we did for them was gratuitous. It was a gift. Lucas?
Is his name Rod? Rod? Is that his name?
No. Oh. In fact, he managed to get the city guys came by. Because I don't, I usually don't get them until very late at night.
What for?
So, yes. You can't, there's no right to be, I don't want to say Indian here, or maybe somebody in here with Native American blood, and I don't want to be racist about it, that's just a good term. But you can't give somebody a gift and say, well, you didn't pay me for this, and so now I want it back. No, because there was never any reasonable expectation of payment in the first place. It was given for gratuitous reasons. And so a gift might create a moral obligation, but doesn't create a legal obligation. And that brings us to Michigan's engagement ring rule. Michigan Supreme Court says that an engagement ring is considered to be a conditional gift. An interesting ruling by the court. A condition, so in other words, unless the condition that the ring was given for is fulfilled, it's not intended to be a permanent gift. By the way, the legal term for a gift is intended to be a permanent gift. This won't be on the test for those of you that know this stuff. It's called an inter vivos gift. A gift becomes an inter vivos gift if the marriage occurs, but if the marriage doesn't occur, guess what? It's the man's property. That's what the Michigan Supreme Court says. Now, an argument can be made that a gift, that this is like what? An option contract. Remember when we talked about option contracts last week? You agree to hold the property out of the market for a period of time, and you get paid some money for holding the property out of the market for a certain period of time. Well, the same principle applies. You can say, hey, man, I could have had a bunch of other good choices. There are other guys that wanted to marry me. But I held myself out of the market and waited all this time, and then you didn't marry me. That's my ring. That's my consideration for keeping myself out of the market. And I think that's a good argument. Michigan Supreme Court didn't buy that. So, guys, I hate to be on the other side here on the issue, but I actually think that's bogus. And it should, I think an engagement ring is a gift. And it keeps somebody out of the market. And that's what I think. But Michigan Supreme Court doesn't care what I think. So, actually, I don't care what they do. Okay. Adequacy of consideration. It's not an issue. There's no requirement that consideration be equal. The judge isn't going to be sitting there with his instruments and measurements and calculator and trying to figure out whether each side got equal consideration. Not required. Some people get good deals in the marketplace. Some people don't get good deals in the marketplace. That's just the way it goes. Forbearance of consideration. See on page bottom of 334. That's important. The forbearance rule means that the consideration, of course, it has to be something of value, usually money, services, or labor, but there's other things it can be. Forbearance means you gave up the right to do something you had a right to do. Well, why wasn't that argument good enough for the Supreme Court on the engagement ring rule? I have no idea. I gave up my right to get married to somebody else. No, not good enough. This is good enough for consideration to support a contract. This will constitute one of the two arrows. And I always give a classic example. We have any smokers in here? Mike, I will pay you $1,000 if you stop smoking for 30 days.
Done.
That's forbearance, because at least outside, and in his own home and in his own car, Mike has a right to smoke. So forbearance means that Mike gave up the right to do something that he had a legal right to do. That's that's consideration to support a contract. So nobody can say, what was the benefit there? What was the benefit that I got? I didn't get any benefit, no. Doesn't matter. His giving up a legal right that he had to do something is forbearance. And the other term the book uses, probably use instead of forbearance, is legal detriment. Legal detriment is consideration to support a contract, giving up the right to yourself and the right to do it. The other thing that can be consideration is forgiveness of a valid debt. Page 335, illusory promises. We've already mentioned that term last week. An illusory promise is you can't really figure out, page 335, you can't really figure out what somebody actually obligated themselves to do. He said something about buying some stuff for me, and they didn't say how much, how many they wanted, they didn't say when they were going to come in and do it, they didn't say cash or credit. That's not a contract. That's not an offer that can be accepted because it's not specific enough. Illusory promises, like smoke and mirrors. Now, we talked about two exceptions last week when this came up. We're jumping ahead. There's a lot of overlap in these chapters. Forgiveness of a debt?
Oh, it's forgiveness.
So this is going to come back to us, and it's called the pre-existing duty rule. We're going to get to this shortly, back again. But remember last week, there were two situations that were illusory promises that the courts have said we won't enforce. Requirements and output contracts. Because the courts understand that this is a modern practice of businesses, and it's really essential for businesses to be able to grow and market their wares and to compete with other businesses. So if you say, I will buy all of whatever you need for your business, I will provide to you. Don't look at anybody else. Don't look at any of my competitors. Every single material you need to get your business up and going, everything that you need in that plant, I will provide you. That's not illusory because it's assumed that the person making that promise did some research and has some ability to know that they can fulfill that promise. On the other hand, the other situation is whatever you put out in that business, whatever rolls off your assembly line, I will buy. All of it. That is kind of seems like it's illusory, but it's legally enforceable because the court, again, these are contracts between businesses, and the courts expect that people have done some research, and they know that they can do it. And there's also an obligation of good faith built in. If it can be shown that you're not acting in good faith when you make that contract, and you're really trying to hurt the other party, the court won't enforce it. Those are two situations with illusory promises that the court will enforce. Conditional promises, we actually jumped ahead and talked about that last week too. Conditional promises, the parties agree that if a certain event doesn't occur, they're not going to be bound, they're not going to have a contract. We're making this agreement now to get ready for this, so we'll be able to go on that date. But if this thing gets canceled, this project gets canceled, then I'm not going to have to deliver you those building materials. Because if the financing doesn't come through and the project doesn't get canceled, sort of like that roof hub that we're supposed to have in downtown Midland got canceled after they were halfway through building the place. There's no need, you will have no need for the materials, obviously, if the financing doesn't go through and the project is canceled. So if that happens, I'm off the hook and I don't have to deliver the goods. Okay, now we get to the pre-existing duty rule on page 336.
This is the multiple choice question on our next test also.
Your commitment to a party can only serve as consideration for one contract, not two or three. So if you're already obligated by contract, I say forgiveness of the debt. We can incur debt in ways other than contracts. talk about that later. But if you have a contractual obligation of money to somebody and you haven't paid it, if you say this, hey, you know that money I paid you for that last contract we had? I'll pay it if you agree to this new contract. No. Under the pre-existing duty rule, there's no new contract even if the other party agreed. Because all you had is consideration that the party was already obligated to pay and hadn't paid. There have to be fresh consideration, new commitment, a new offer of payment to support a new contract. Now, we have exceptions, but that's the general rule. Pre-existing duty rule. This comes up in contexts involving police officers and firemen. The fire marshal has an obligation to investigate the cause of the fire. So if the fire marshal finds the person, the perpetrator, who torched the building, he can't go down and collect the reward money. Because he has a pre-existing duty on his job to find who first torched the building. The police officer that catches the criminal that there's a reward out for, the police officer can't go down and collect the reward. Actually, for two reasons. One, because he has a pre-existing duty to go out and catch the criminal. But also because that public offer of a reward wasn't made to him. It was excluding a law enforcement officer. The purpose of the reward money is to induce a member of the public to come forth and help the police with information to help catch the criminal. Now we have a major exception on this pre-existing duty rule. Settlement of legal disputes. Because the courts want people to settle their disputes short of jury trial, tying up courts, costly, having to pay jurors and all this stuff. If the parties settle a lawsuit, if we applied the pre-existing duty rule literally, that would pretty much prevent a lot of cases from being settled. So the only thing is that there's a good faith disagreement on what is owed, then the pre-existing duty rule does not prevent an enforcement of a settlement for less than what a party is claiming they were owed. Of course, this is never going to be a problem in a court case, because in a court case, there's no contract, and who knows how much damages the jury's going to award. It's only going to be in a breach of contract case. However, if it's clear that I owe Jeremy $500, and there's just no doubt, on the basis of a contract, there's no issue. I just didn't pay him. The pre-existing duty rule should say that if I paid him $250, he could come after me for the second $250. But the courts say if a lawsuit was filed, it doesn't matter. We can settle them for $250 because the courts want legal disputes settled. And they're not going to worry about the pre-existing duty rule in that situation. So if there's a pending lawsuit, there's no problem with the pre-existing duty rule. So even if I only agree to pay him $100, as long as he accepts it. Why? Because there's reasons why he would do this. There's reasons why you accept less than the money than you're actually owed in a legal dispute. One is the party can go bankrupt. If I went bankrupt, he wouldn't get a nickel. That wouldn't be good for him. If he has to continue the lawsuit, he's going to incur court costs and legal bills, maybe. So he gains something also from a settlement. I mean, lawsuits can be tied up in courts for years. The value of the money now is different 3 or 4 years from now, and so on and on. There's lots of reasons why. Like if there's never been a lawsuit, never been a lawsuit. Let's use that same example. I owe, clearly I owe Jeremy $500, but I send him a check for $250. And I say, Jeremy, paid in full. He can disregard the paid in full, because I got a pre-existing duty rule, pre-existing duty to pay him the other $250. People think they can do this on the memo portion of a check. You ever seen this? Paid in full. You can disregard that. In fact, you can take your pen and line it right out. Somebody does that to you. The memo portion of a check is just for reference. It doesn't have any legal consequences. The only way to create legal consequences on a check, and I don't want to get too far into checks because that's business law too, but you can try to condition an endorsement with this language. Endorsement by payee, the person whom the check is made payable, constitutes acceptance as payment in full. If you do that, in my opinion, and the person goes ahead and signs, endorses it there, they've agreed to, that changes the contract obligation. Otherwise, negotiable instruments law under the UCC, Article 3, is all separate from contract law. Negotiable instruments law has their own set of rules on this stuff. Now, you might say, well, you can't do all that because you'll use up that little space for the endorsement. Forget that stupid line, okay? Under Michigan law, you can put an endorsement anywhere you want on there. The reason why the banks do this is because they want, for two reasons. One, they want the check out of the stream of commerce as soon as possible. They don't want it being endorsed anymore. But they want to leave all this space for bank endorsements, stamps, bank endorsements all over the place, because these checks travel. And anybody here work at a bank? These checks travel from one bank to another, to another, to another. In order for that traveling to take place, the check is really what we call a courier without luggage. You got to have room for the endorsements, or it can't travel.
I don't have to actually endorse checks to cash or to deposit them at my bank. If you did that and I cashed it, would my cashing the check be considered the same? If you wrote something like that on the back.
Yeah, and you endorsed it knowing that.
I didn't endorse it though.
Accepting it as payment in full.
I don't endorse it. I can give them a check and they'll just.
No, because you didn't sign it then.
Okay.
That would be the way to handle it.
Okay.
So if somebody tried to do that to you with a letter with the check, you can throw the letter out. Because the letter doesn't control the check under Michigan Negotiable Instruments. So he can still come after me for the $250. Or if he put in the memo portion of the check in the front, paid in full, forget about it. And line it out that it's irrelevant. Doesn't have any legal meaning whatsoever. So you can. So people call me and say, well, Mr. Dunn, he owes me a lot more. Should I accept the check? Yeah, you accept the check. Now he owes you not quite as much. Accept the check. Now I'll go after him for the rest.
Unless the person put that on the back.
Yeah, and this, even this, I've seen some court decisions that have said even this isn't enough. I've seen some court decisions say it is. But that's the least you have to do. Moral obligation, we talked a little bit already. Charitable subscriptions, page 340, special rule to protect charities. Charities, your promise to pay a charity is enforceable, even though there's no mutual bargain for exchange consideration. For public policy reasons, to protect charities, because government knows that if charities can't raise money, government's going to end up footing the bill. That takes us to promissory estoppel. Only a couple paragraphs, but yet a huge doctrine. Promissory estoppel is a doctrine, is a way to be able to collect money from somebody even when they're on a contract type obligation, even when the owner of the contract really aren't there. Here's the idea behind promissory estoppel. If you reasonably induce, not fraudulently, because when you induce them, you were telling them the truth at that time. So it's not fraud in the inducement. But you reasonably induce somebody to change their legal position and incur detriment and do things they otherwise wouldn't do, quit their job, move out of town, start a new business, give up what they had, because they reasonably believe in your promise to them. And then later say, oh, sorry, I just can't do it. And then you're saying, look, man, I moved out here. You said we were going to start a business together. You've never lied to me before. Quit my job. My wife quit her job. We're out here. And you say, you don't have anything for me here? That's the situation for promissory estoppel. Because what I was describing, that person actually had suffered. It was a legal detriment. It was just had on the board. But you still only have one arrow with the contract, not two. And that is a legal detriment. Because this guy over here never specifically promised anything in particular. Just that, come on out here, we got a great start of business. This is going to be the best thing that ever happened. I've researched this. Let's go. Let's do it. Promissory estoppel. A promissor may be prevented from asserting that his or her promise is unenforceable because of no consideration. Reading on the bottom of 340 here, the doctrine is sometimes called the doctrine of detrimental reliance. It's applicable when the promisor makes a promise that lacks consideration, and the guy that made the promise, there was no consideration to support that. He didn't get anything in exchange for that. He just said, you, quit your job, come on out here, bring your wife, bring your kids, come on out here, we're going to start a business. And it was believable as he described it to you, what the plan was. The promisor intends or should reasonably expect that the promisee, the guy who quit his job and left, will rely on the promise, and he does in fact rely on the promise in some definite and substantial manner. Enforcement of the promise is the only way to avoid injustice. So you have an equitable remedy under promissory estoppel to be able to go into a court, circuit court, and get compensation to reimburse you for what you lost in your moving expenses, lost income from quitting the job, wife's lost income from quitting her job, and any other expenses you incurred in going out there. When there was nothing there for you when you got there. Or maybe the guy disappeared or something. Whatever the case may be. Lucas?
All right, so where I work, our process when we hire people is we'll go through the interview and then we'll make them a verbal offer, and then we'll send them a written offer, and then we hire them. Now, we'll tell them that they don't have the job until they get the written offer. And occasionally we'll...
Be careful about that.
Occasionally we'll even back out after that. But, so if we make a verbal offer, they accept it and quit their job, then we have some potential liability here. If we make a written offer, they accept it, quit their job, and we don't fulfill it, then we have even more liability, correct?
More for the written, because the verbal, you run into the statute of frauds. And the statute of frauds for an oral contract, it has to be capable of being completed within a year.
Oh, no, these are all much shorter times. It's
okay, so these are temporary jobs.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
This is permanent employment.
Permanent employment.
No,
yeah.
then you're okay on the oral.
Okay.
But you got to be careful. Be careful about that. I had to make them sign something stating that... that even though we made this offer, you know, it's not final yet until the final papers are signed or something like that. Some banks and refinancing places will make you sign a promissory estoppel waiver as part of the closing. I don't think anybody's ever seen this. And so it just means that you can't sue them if the financing doesn't go through under a theory of promissory estoppel. I've seen that. Situations I've been involved in. Labor law has we're going to talk about labor law later, but since Lucas brought it up,
called the Tucson Doctrine. Anybody ever heard of that? This situation. You go to your employer and you tell your employer you're going to go to work for a competitor. Employer doesn't want that. Because the competitor offered you a whole lot more money. And your boss didn't seem to want to pay you what you really were worth. And of course, your employer is bothered by that. Oh my God, you know about all of our trade secrets, and now you're going to market. Tell you what, I will match that. Not only will I match that offer that the competitor gave you, I guarantee you got a job for life if you stay here. Never have to worry. That means you're not an employee at will anymore. Now you're a just cause employee. And we'll talk more about that later. You can't just fire them. You're a just cause employee. And so the person gives up that opportunity that they would have had for a substantial raise, stays on, gets booted a couple of months later, that same opportunity is no longer available for them because the competitor hired somebody else. That's labor laws, promissory estoppel, that's called a Tucson lawsuit. And that, those are the facts, you can file suit and either get reinstated permanently through some equitable remedy or obtain money damages for the salary you would have received for lifetime employment. I'm not going to spend much time on Chapter 16. All Chapter 16 is, there's some categories where contracts are legally unenforceable. Not the voidability situation, but just unenforceable. That we're just going to go through real quickly here. If it's illegal, not enforced. If it's a contract that charges an illegal rate of interest, it's called usury, USCRY. The extent to which you'd have to pay an illegal interest, not enforceable, even if otherwise the contract was enforceable. And by the way, interest is everything that's charged for credit. They can't say, well, this is the interest, these are the finance charges, these are the late charges. No, it's all interest. And if by adding it all up, it exceeds the legal rate of interest. And you don't have to know the legal rate of interest in my class because the legal rate of interest is different for every kind of transaction. But it's not enforceable. It exceeds the legal rate of interest. Unconscionable clauses on page 350. Very subjective. What unconscionability is that we have an extreme, even though we know consideration doesn't have to be equal. We've already said that. Make a good deal and you can make a bad deal. But if the contract is so one-sided that you have a real case of unjust enrichment and a party being damaged and hurt by the enforcement of a contract considerably to the point where it's bothering the judge's conscience, that's the doctrine of unconscionability. Classic example of that was the Williams versus Walker Thomas Furniture case, which is the first unconscionability case out of Washington, D.C. And just one of these rent-to-own places. So that if you're late on a single payment, we come and repossess all the furniture. These people have been paying on this for a year. They were late on payment. The company wanted to be able to come back and take the furniture and not give them any money back. So they lost everything. Court refused. It was so one-sided and unfair in the mind of the court that they refused to enforce it. So I don't really test much on this because it's kind of subjective and it depends upon how a judge feels about a situation. It's got to be really bad. Really, you got a party that can't really read. You got all kinds of technical big words that one party puts in the contract, knowing that other party's not going to be able to understand those words. And that. So. That's all you have for that. Gambling contracts outside of casinos that are legal, obviously not enforceable. Contracts in restraint of trade. These come up in two situations. We're just about to wrap up here. Sale of a business. employee hiring. The goodwill of a business is a substantial value of the business. The goodwill of the business is the extent to which a certain person is known as that business in the community, and the location of that business is known in the community. It's sort of like the goodwill that the Xerox company developed with copy machines. The Xerox, you think copy, you think Xerox. If you think cola, you think Coke first, before Pepsi. People think Coke before Pepsi, the biggest majority. That's the goodwill of the business. You can't sell the goodwill of the business because a price is fixed, that's part of the purchase price, and then turn right around and open up a competing business two blocks away. That'd be in breach of that contract for the sale of the business when you sold the goodwill of the business. And so, contract and restraint of trade would be this. The person who sold that business can be forced to stay out of that business, but not forever, but within a certain area that's considered reasonable, and for a certain amount of time. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, I've seen courts buy that, that's no problem. And area-wise, it depends on the business. If it's a business you've seen one on every corner, then maybe not so far away. If it's a business you only have one in that community, then probably three communities away would be okay.
Now, would this type of thing also go for, like, if a business is coming into a community?
If it's what?
A business is coming into a community. Because I remember in Stamford, when the McDonald's came into town a couple of years back.
Well, that's a whole different issue.
Was that a sign? No. Stamford had a sign.
And employee hiring is the other thing. Hairstyling business is classic. If you're going to work as a hairstylist here, you've got to agree that if you quit here, you can't work for any other hairstylist for a certain length of time and within a certain area. The courts will enforce that only for a limited period of time, a year probably, because you think a year, that's the amount of time you should get unemployment, at least a year. Any area, probably 30-mile radius, maybe. I know there are ladies in Bay City that go all the way to Mount Pleasant to have their hair done. There's a place in Mount Pleasant. My son used to go there, I guess. I guess it's extremely popular in Mount Pleasant. I don't know the name of it. So I'd say 40, 50-mile radius, okay, but beyond that, the contract would be unenforceable as a restraint of trade, violates public policy, because you can't force people out of work. The courts don't want to enter judgments that just continually force people out of work. Same thing with the sale of a business. That guy's got to be out of that business for a period of time, and he can't be near where the old business was. And then the court would enforce that.
Is that avoidable if they're minor?
What's that?
Is it avoidable if they're minor then?
Yeah, that's a different issue. If they're minor. If it's a minor, then the rules are all different. The question then is, would this be necessary for a minor? And contracts that relieve yourself of your own negligence, usually not enforceable. Okay. So you leave your coat with a hat check, lady, at the fancy club. The coat is damaged, but it wasn't through her fault. Somehow, I'm kind of thinking of a good factual scenario when it comes up. It was not through her fault. And there's a little sign there that said, we're not responsible. She's not responsible. She was negligent, and her negligence contributed to the damage or loss of the coat. The little sign does not protect the business. So instead of being there watching the coats, she goes off to the bar for an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. People come in and steal the coats. That little sign that says that we're not responsible won't protect them. You can't contract yourself away from the consequences of your own negligence, Lucas.
So when I go to Myers or anywhere, and they've got a sign up that says not responsible for damage to your car from a cart, does that alleviate
you? If you can prove that that happened because of their negligence,
and they got carts laying around there,
then they got a problem.
So like you show up and there's carts everywhere and they have to take up carts all day?
Well, it takes
but you
place.
Have the burden of proving that they were unreasonable in the situation, and that they were being negligent. So that's really going to only help them in a strict liability situation. Pick up where we left off next week, dealing with a problem.